The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests. Arielle Delgado Dixon's debut novel follows two sisters who are largely self-raised and must navigate their young adulthood under the shadow of their chaotic childhood. Early reviews called it propulsive, a striking literary arrival by a prose stylist with a rare talent marked by atmospheric rhythm. She has published earlier work in Kenyon Review and O, the Oprah Magazine, among other places, and she was a nominee for the Penn Robert J. Dow Short Story Award for Emerging Writers and shortlisted for the Master's Review Anthology Prize. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with award-winning novelist and professor Sarah Novick. We're glad to present this event in collaboration with Blue Stoop, a home for Philly writers, offering rigorous classes in the craft of writing and free weekly drop-in programs and other community events. Blue Stoop nurtures an inclusive literary community. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Hi, gang. So I'm going to start off by just reading a little bit from the book, about a third of the way through, just a page and a half, not too long. Thank you guys so much for coming. It's nice to see all you here. All right. When I was deemed fit for reentry into the world, I went where everyone else was going. The city was obvious. A parent had been felled, funds bequeathed, money burned a hole in my pocket, and I was keenly aware that I'd arrived at the same crossroads my parents had at my age. I told myself to make sound decisions as a tribute to my father. He labored nonstop to amass his modest fortune, but had been struck from the earth before he could fully enjoy the spoils. I rented a streamlined one-bedroom in his old neighborhood. What was once considered blight was now considered character, like the two-screen movie theater with its busted seats, the bodega called Batteries, Cigarettes, Hot Dogs, ATM, with its obese black cat. Even the pocket park had its own scuffed-up allure, shaded by a giantess photinia shrub in which rats scrabbled and birthed. To these wayward charms, I was not immune. I saw myself waging a scenic life, a life in montage. I was part of something. Like weather, the neighborhood happened to all of us. I was fresh from Veld then and had been hammered into certain habits. I fought the duplicitous urge to journal, to garden, to report to the kitchen for my posts, but this new freedom was full of tripwires, Pavlovian lunges towards self-improvement and public vulnerability. Some mornings I'd wake up with no idea whether I was indoors or out. I dreamt of deep ravines that beckoned, their deceiving sunken centers jagged with rocks and splintered trunks. I had seen a girl go rolling headfirst into one while she was still strapped into her 30-pound pack. The sound, the rattle of camp cutlery and carabiners as she bounced down haunted me. I dreamt often of the unjust angle of her leg as she slammed into the ground and went still, but even when I woke, there was no relief. Sure as I was that two goons were coming to bust through my door, cart me back there against my will, and make me earn my way out again. I became obsessed with the rituals of security. From above, I watched the streets fill and empty on repeat. Everything had to be shut, sealed, and checked twice, or else some nefarious caller might break down the door or scale four floors and climb into my window, discover me in my bed, and make me pay. I took the job at the restaurant to meet people. My kitchen work detail at Veld had been educational, and prep work whittled down my thinking. I watched in wonder as my hands moved in symmetry and produced nourishment. I liked the feel of a knife in my grip. I appreciated the efficiency expressed by a sharp edge. I was hardly good enough for a city kitchen, but I could wait tables at least. Finito was an upscale but discreet neighborhood spot a few blocks away, with thick velvet curtains and a front door gold leaf with a loping letter F. I practiced the route to work twice before my first shift. I clicked through reviews of the restaurant, then clicked through to the profiles of reviewers and went down an endless chute of tangential impressions. I could hardly wait to take orders. I believed it was the beginning of the rest of my life. Thanks.
All right. Yay. I really love this book, so I'm happy to be here with all of you. And, well, tell me about it. You're a debutante now. How do you feel?
It's been a wild ride. We were talking about this a little bit before, but, yeah, I wrote this book what feels like a long time ago now, and now it's finally out in the world, and it feels like it's kind of far away, but it's a nice little dip to revisit now with everybody, so, yeah.
When did you start writing, finish writing this guy?
I started in grad school as part of like your final thesis project, year three. That would have been like 2018, 2019, and tried to just kick through it in a year and get as much done as I could while I was still feeling the energy of deadlines in class. And I took a couple months to edit, and it was kind of a whirlwind, just about a year and a half of active work, and then all the in-between of selling it and publishing it. It's like another 18 months tacked on, but it's been done now for almost a year, so.
That's so fast. I'm so jealous.
It didn't feel that way.
Yeah, well, when you're in it. But yes, of course, we've had like 42 years between 2018 and 2022, right?
Yeah, at least that, yeah.
Okay, well, I have some questions for you. So this was an MFA, sort of an MFA project. Was it something that you workshopped or just kind of like was writing after the fact?
I did, I wrote a short story that is a chapter later on in the book, just sort of test driving the dynamic between the sisters in the book and just trying to get a sense of mood and setting. And I did workshop that my third year in my MFA. And it was good, like wasn't a scary, like shredder kind of workshop that happened. But it was good practice to sort of dip my toe in and see how far I wanted to take it. And before I came to my MFA, I knew I wanted to write a novel, and I arrived with one idea that I never ended up writing about my years in Christian school, which I recognize some of the faces here from. But this book kind of took over, was inspired by a friend who had some experiences at places like Veld, like a behavioral school for wayward teen girls. But that's kind of just one part of the book, and the other characters and threads and themes sort of sprung up around that.
Great. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Veld. It feels so real and scary. So did you have to do a lot of research to make that happen, or was it more just kind of like, I'm going to imagine the darkest?
My friend who had some of these experiences is a really good storyteller. And so she just had like a lot of good details and impressions squirreled away that I could use as a jumping off point. But I've talked about this a little bit before, but there's no like real character in it that's based on her exactly. So it did require a lot of invention and research. Schools like these and programs like these that are set up for usually young people that are having like a tough time in conventional school settings, they'll set off on these intense wilderness retreats in different parts of the country and then go to these intensely structured schools that some just have like a therapeutic component, some are a lot more intense and security oriented. But I did a lot of digging about that online. But there's a lot of resources that exist out there. A lot of people who have been through these programs have big forums and talk about their experiences, and there's like a movement to try and sort of limit the power that these places have. So there was a lot of stories out there and a lot of people wanting to talk about it. Probably the most famous example is the big Paris Hilton documentary that came out maybe a year ago, where she talks a little bit about her experiences there. So yeah, there's a lot to draw from.
I am going to go look that up now.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, yeah.
So, okay, so you said you kind of started with the two sisters as like maybe the first thing that you wrote. How did you kind of structure, this book moves around in time, so how did you get all those pieces, puzzle pieces together?
Yeah, well, for better or worse, that's just the way that I've always written. Chronology has never been my main interest or strong suit, so jumping around in time and like the leakage between different points in your life was always a part of the structure of the book. And in some ways it was helpful to like keep momentum if you're talking about childhood and working towards like a peak moment there, and then you cut away towards a later moment in the present when these sisters have reunited as young adults in New York. Bouncing back and forth can keep some momentum up that way. But yeah, the puzzle piece part of it was hard. In editing, if you move one thing, it was like a domino effect of all the two other timelines in the novel. So yeah, it took some trial and error, and I started leaving myself notes as I went so I could keep track of it all. I mean, after like 300 pages, it starts blurring together a little bit. So yeah, I had to make myself my own cheat sheet, which was helpful.
So are you basically like making an outline but after the fact, or?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to put it. I wrote through the draft, and then when I went back in editing, just kind of had to map out what I was doing, where cleaner connections could be made between these three timelines that are in the book. And every time like a timeline breaks, so like when they're very young and growing up in this warehouse outside of New York, when it moves to a different point in time, maybe when they're older as teenagers and at places like Veld's, I wanted wherever their childhood thread left off to inform where we were going in the next timeline. So making sure that there was some correspondence between timelines, even if it felt maybe more abstract sometimes, was important, and definitely happened a lot more in editing. It was just easier to pull stuff out and connect it that way than just in the first draft. So yeah, it was frustrating sometimes, but like good surprises happen, things that you didn't plan on in your first draft that you realize you've left some breadcrumbs for yourself, images that can echo each other through different timelines. That's kind of the fun surprise of editing and writing as you go.
Do you have anything on the cutting room floor that you kind of miss or just like, you know, liked but couldn't fit in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to overwrite than underwrite. So there must have been like 500 pages total. So a lot really did get cut. But probably, probably my favorite thing that I had to let go of a little bit. There's a thread in the book where the main character, who is unnamed, the narrator of the novel, is obsessed with like a teen TV series that's loosely based on like Dawson's Creek, Felicity, that golden era of WB TV shows. And obviously I was like a big student of the shows growing up. And that was one of the funner things to write, was like making up my own TV show for the purpose of this character to be obsessed with. But it's because I could go on about that a lot in the book, and it's not so much a main thread as like a one character's preoccupation. Yeah, the editing notes from multiple people along the way were like, this is good, but like, we could probably do like half and it would be fine. So yeah, I did let go of some of that. But I did fight to keep the parts that are in there, and I don't regret it.
So why no name for your narrator? Do you have feelings about that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is never really coming upon a name that felt right, but I think a big part of this book is shifty identities, and even her sister, whose name is Fawn, kind of assumes some other identities by the end of the book. And if a big part of it is trying to figure out who you are and what's changeable about who you are, it felt right to sort of leave that open and a secret that she gets to keep, even though she's kind of oversharing in her narration. So that felt nice to be able to keep unwritten.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite character?
Yeah, I think I have two favorite characters. One is an older woman. Her name is Rochelle. The narrator of the books begins dating her, and Rochelle also happens to occupy the narrator's childhood home, which is kind of how they meet in a moment of pre-planned fate that way. I like Rochelle because she's like a very decadent person. She's older and established and wealthy and has a penchant for spreadsheets. Like, she's obsessed with documenting her life, and in our like data-crazed age, it was fun seeing what that looked like on a personal level. What sort of things you're keeping track of, like your skincare routine, what you're eating, how your sexual encounters are going, keeping track of like your work rivals, and what that would look like stretched out on a spreadsheet that you update with your own sort of key. So I liked writing her. I don't feel much of a kinship with her as a somewhat disorganized person, but it was fun pretending for a minute. The other character I liked was Victor, who's the roommate of the narrator in the present day, who's kind of like a New Jersey hustler, just trying to find like a good job, become an entrepreneur, make his own money, make his own way, and has, you know, that kind of Jersey attitude about him. I'm from New Jersey, so obviously I have a little bit of a bias there. But yeah, he just felt like a sweet guy who's trying to make it work and is like a good touchstone for the main character, a point of steadiness for her. So it was nice having someone who's just sort of like kind and innocent in a world that's a little bit darker in the novel.
Yeah, they are two really different characters than like the rest of the mood of the, so it's cool to know that you were kind of thinking about them especially. Also, I would have read an entire book just of like crazy Excel spreadsheets that Michelle made.
I have fun with those. Yeah, she has a lot of them. It made me want to experiment with like if I really looked at my life that way and had to break it down numerically, but impossible. It was easier to write about in the abstract than I could ever possibly do it. So,
yeah, it seems
fascinating
and terrible. But I'm like afraid of numbers as a writer a little bit. So maybe you.
That's why we got into this game.
Let me see. Oh, okay. All right. So, you sit down to dinner with a friend, and you're like, I just had the best writing day ever. Like, what is the perfect writing routine production thing that happens? And you like, this, if I could make this happen every day, this is what I would want my routine to be.
This is a good question, and I've been getting a glimpse of it kind of lately, but I think my idea would be to drink a bunch of coffee in the morning, write for a couple hours, and then get that like rush of virtuousness over having been productive, and then go outside for the rest of the day. That's the dream. Yeah, I am. When I'm not writing, I work part time at a organic dairy farm in New Jersey with one of my best friends. And yeah, I tell her all the time, like, the mornings when I write before I go in and then spend the rest of the day with the cows and like outside and walking around, that's a dream. It's the perfect balance of feeling like you've done something, staring at a computer, and then realizing that it's kind of a small thing in the face of like the real natural world where you are not so powerful. So that's the dream. It's not always so lucky. I mean, I'm sure you know, there's plenty of times when you sit down with the best intentions to write and not much happens. But setting out the time to do it every day is the goal. And right now, that's been somewhat possible, at least to block out in my schedule. So as I work on the next book.
Do you write on the computer? Do you write at home?
Yeah, I write on the computer. I feel like it's very romantic to write by hand, and I'm sure that there are tons of benefits to doing it, but my hand gets tired and my brain is moving too fast. And yeah, I grew up taking, you know, those typewriting classes in, fourth grade? So yeah, that's my preferred medium. I do write at home sometimes, but I mostly like to write coffee shops. I like just like the buzz of other people doing things and trying to be productive and not wander into my kitchen to clean something and distract myself from sitting down to do work. So yeah, I'll walk about 10 minutes to Two Persons at the Bach Building. If you're from South Philly, you know that spot. And yeah, that's where I do a lot of my writing, with like a lot of oat milk lattes as my rent for my table. And yeah, that's where I've been doing most of my work lately.
What are you working on now?
So right now I'm working on a second novel for Random House. It's still early, but right now it follows a marijuana farm in Northern California. The leader of this farm has died suddenly, and there's sort of a power vacuum for who will take over this operation and which direction it'll go. And it's set in the backdrop amid like legalization in California. So yeah, it's like a really rich history up there. So many of the weed operations began as utopian communes in the 60s and 70s, and they were growing weed because they wanted it and then realized it made them the most money, so it became a business. And it's like a scary place, but one with, I think, that began with a lot of good intentions. But yeah, so that's what I'm working on now. It's told in two perspectives, also as of now, who knows what'll happen, but it feels really far away from the subject of this book, so it's been fun to research and fun to dream about California a little bit, which has been nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, we can read it in like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Just gotta get typing as soon as I leave here. That's my plan.
All right. Well, I think we'd like to open up to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, you can just raise your hand and they'll bring you a mic because they're recording, so everyone can hear the question out there.
Can you talk a little bit more about your research process, especially for your next project? Are you traveling? What's it like in terms of, you know, reaching out to people who work in that industry? How are you getting information direct from the source?
So I went to undergrad in Southern California at USC, and my sophomore year I did a California road trip with some close friends, and we spent most of it going through Northern California and went through actually Garberville, which is a central town in the Humboldt area, and it did have like a weird vibe to it. It felt ghost towny, but there were like people around, but yeah, that was like the first peak of interest. So one part of the research is I'd like to go back and spend some time in Northern California. It's just like a really beautiful and unique place that I kind of just want to get like the smell of a little bit. But luckily there are a lot of good resources for this particular subject. There's a ton of nonfiction about it. But I also have like some contacts in the industry through friends of friends who are surprisingly chatty about the topic. And I think it's like more widespread than people think. I mean, it's becoming more legal in different states recreationally or medically. And it's just been around for a long time. People have a lot of funny, odd stories about it. Yeah, so between chatting with people who are in the industry, the nonfiction, even academic writing about it, and then hopefully spending some time out there, that's the idea. But I think in the same as the first book, it'll be like a big set piece and theme, but usually I'm thinking about like what kind of weird character would end up at a place like this, and that gives me some more freedom to just make stuff up, which is nice. Thanks, that was a good question.
Hi, Ariel.
Hi.
So in terms of editing, how much of the editing do you do, and how much does your publisher do? And like, if your book was 500 pages, do they tell you have to cut it down to 350 and then you do the editing, or somebody else does it? Also, I know that originally you had a different title to the book. Can you tell us what that was and then why
sure.
you changed?
Sure. I'll answer the first part first. So editing was kind of two-part for this book. I'd written it. It was kind of long. I think the draft that I submitted to my professor at the time, Brady Udall, who was like a big champion of the book, was maybe like closer to 400 pages. And he had a lot of suggestions of where it could be cut. But even just putting it on a shelf for 2 months and then going back to it, it was so much easier to see what was redundant, where I was repeating myself, what were my own little pet interests that were not really serving the larger plot. And I think cutting from the manuscript is kind of fun. It's like, yeah, it's like pruning, like it's stripping that away. Can be sad to let some things go, but ultimately something stronger comes out. So part of that was my own and with the suggestion of a professor. And then when I sold the book and I worked with my editor at Random House, Andrea Walker, she also had good suggestions about I think we reorganized one chapter in time, and they were closer notes about what are we trying to say here? This is a little bit unclear, or something continuity-wise, or like what's the motivation of this character, and how do we pull it out to make it stronger and serve the story better? So by that point, it was more fine-tuning. At least on this book, there weren't any major overhauls once I got to that process. There was an alternate title for the book. It was called, during my thesis days, The Myth Belongs to Me. It changed. I just like the immediacy of this title a little bit more, and it felt a little bit less stuffy and mysterious. I don't dislike the other one, but yeah, this is where we ended up, and I think it's a little bit spookier and more provocative, so I'm sorry why I chose it. Oh boy.
Well, it's more a comment. With your next novel, it seems like it's going to be pretty relevant with, you know, legalizing marijuana for recreational use in different states. And I just want to comment, it's probably kind of well timed for, hopefully it'll be like, you know, just relevant and people will be picking it up.
I mean, here's hoping. Yeah, that's always, I mean, that would be a nice unplanned coincidence. Yeah, I think it's a topic that has just continued to come more to the fore as more states legalize. But I'm sure it must exist, but I just haven't read a lot about like sort of first-person perspectives, fictional or otherwise, that have come out of that place. So yeah, here's hoping that, I think it's going to be legal in New Jersey relatively soon, and hopefully Pennsylvania soon, so we'll see.
One more question for Ariel before we split.
Hey, Riri.
Hey.
So, I know you were already asked what your ideal writing day looks like, but what is your favorite part of writing, of the whole process? Like, what do you really enjoy doing, but, you know?
Yeah. I think my favorite part is the rabbit holes that you can get into in research and writing. I've talked a little bit about this before, but yeah, you could go digging for what music would be playing during a certain era at a certain place. You could be looking at what were the blockbusters of that time, what are people wearing, what are they talking about in the news, how much does airfare cost to Europe in 1970? I mean, there's like endless historical contextual questions that you can just fall down the rabbit hole in finding all kinds of world-building details. And that to me is really fun. It's like, yeah, you're learning a ton about what you're writing about. Usually you're finding a ton of unintended things that you weren't really looking for, but ultimately become useful. And it's like productive work, but it's surprising and not as always mentally taxing as trying to actually write a paragraph and convincing yourself that it sounds good. So yeah, just doing that sort of digging around and research, I think is my favorite part for sure. Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming, guys. You can get signed books upstairs.
Yeah. And, thank you guys so much for coming. I'm going to hop up there and sign some books if you got them. But it was really nice to see all of your faces here. And thank you, Sarah, for chatting with me.
My pleasure.
Free Library, Blue Stoop, Uncle Bobby's, everyone and so many organizations in Philly have been super helpful and supportive of this book. And it's been really, really fun. So thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.